Hello everybody, my name is Guy Foster. Welcome to another Bruin podcast and another turbulent week in UK politics. We've just had the Labour conference end in a policy of more strategic ambiguity over Brexit. We've just heard that proroguing Parliament has been deemed unlawful by the Supreme Court, and the chaos continues. So we're going to spend this podcast asking our expert whether we are reaching the end of this particularly turbulent period of politics.
So I do think late November, possibly spring, looks like possible times for a general election.
Okay, so it sounds like there is still plenty of water to flow under the political bridge. And with that in mind, stay tuned after the following messages to find out how that's all going to unfold.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everybody, welcome to another Bruin podcast. We're going to be talking Brexit, a topic we have touched on briefly in the past, but when you're investing, you particularly really need to cut through some of the noise, and there is a huge amount of noise and quite a partisan lean to a lot of what we tend to read about Brexit. So we're going to try and cut through some of that noise with a really analytical approach, and to do so I'm joined by Chris Hughes, who's a former political researcher who's now working for Cicero Group, and regular listeners may remember Ian Anderson from Cicero has joined us on a few times previously to discuss UK politics. So Chris, thanks very much. Welcome to the podcast. I guess we'll start off with the big news of the week, which is this Supreme Court ruling that essentially proroguing Parliament was unlawful, and so it's back to work for all of the MPs. What is the actual impact of this ruling? What does it change?
So it's a huge ruling constitutionally. In terms of what it's going to change politically, Parliament was supposed to be suspended until the 14th of October for a Queen's speech, and that's now no longer the case. Before I came here, Speaker John Bercow confirmed that Parliament would now return tomorrow afternoon at 11:30. So we are now going to see Parliament come back. There will not be a Queen's speech now, at least on the 14th of October.
Right.
And all previous domestic legislation that was thought to have fallen away once Parliament was prorogued will now be live again. We are back to pretty much where we started just before Parliament was prorogued, in the fact that MPs have passed this legislation which seeks to prevent no deal, and they will now seek to use the time that they thought they had lost to just further scrutinise the government's position and possibly even look to reinforce the legislation that they passed by strengthening it some more.
Okay, but the speculation was that this proroguing was to prevent the Benn Bill or some equivalent of the Benn Bill being passed, and then it got passed anyway. So in that sense, does it not change that much?
Well, I think you highlight a good point. I think you know, there has been speculation over the last few weeks that the government are confident they might have seen some sort of loophole in the Benn Bill, and they'll be looking just to make sure that any possibility of that is closed down. They'll also use the opportunity just to put political pressure on the government. You know, if you're calling ministers in front of the, you know, in the chamber, you know, day in, day out, it's a good way of just making sure that the government feels as much pressure as possible.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think in terms of actually Brexit-wise legislation, it won't have changed much, this ruling, but I think it just gives MPs that more time to really put the government under some pressure.
And then no Queen's speech, so that's probably, you know, that's quite important as well, because essentially that speech was going to be used as a sort of campaign speech.
Well, that's right. So the Queen's speech would have given would have basically renewed the legislative programme for the government, and they would have been able to use that to bring forward new legislation. I mean, they don't have a majority anyway, so that would have been very difficult in itself. But you're right, it is a big blow for Johnson.
It was an opportunity to get some publicity for their political agenda, wasn't it?
So that's correct. Yeah. So you know they Boris Johnson over the last 4 weeks has spoken about more money for the NHS, more policemen on the streets, more money for social care, and a Queen's speech would give him the opportunity to highlight that some further. You know, he will still, I'm sure, be going on about that over the next few weeks, given we're probably going to have a general election sometime soon. But you're right, it's a blow for Johnson.
Okay, well, I mean, obviously he's had some publicity for those kind of domestic agenda items, but broadly, I guess the reason the Queen's speech would be useful is because it's been a bit too easy for all of us to focus only on Brexit. So let's do that again now. So, as I mentioned in the intro, there's a real partisan lean to everything that you tend to read about this, so it's really difficult to really get to the nub of what is going on. But what you read quite a lot is that the Tories are actively seeking a no-deal Brexit. Is that an accurate depiction of their strategy as far as you can tell?
Not entirely, in my opinion. I think the Benn legislation has really boxed the government in, and they now know that in order to leave on the 31st of October, really the only route through that is by getting a deal. So that what we've seen over since that legislation has passed has, I think, been, you know, we've seen the government really ramp up efforts to try and get a deal, because if they don't, that legislation effectively will force Johnson to ask for an extension, which is Payne out said that he won't do. So I think there's a lot of effort going in at the moment at securing a deal. Of course, I'm not saying that that means that they will secure one, and if they don't, it's anybody's guess about what Johnson would choose to do next. But I think over the next few weeks there is a real effort in government to try and get a deal.
Okay, and do you not think that was always their strategy, that it was this case of you've got to look willing to accept a no-deal Brexit, otherwise you're not going to get a deal that's acceptable?
I think you're right. I think they, ever since Johnson became Prime Minister, they've tried to use the threat of no-deal, as leverage. But I guess what the Benn legislation did was it really has, boxed them in. In that, you can carry on saying we're going to leave without a deal, but really this legislation sort of prevents that, unless you're going to break the law, or unless, you find a loophole which no one else seems to have managed to really find yet, then you it might well resign rather than ask for the extension.
Yeah.
But I think it's definitely focused minds in government towards getting a deal.
Okay, and then the other thing you tend to read is that they have no proposal for reforming, removing whatever it is, the backstop. Does that seem an accurate depiction of their stance?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to negotiations, I think the government's position will obviously be to try and remove the backstop, to try and form an alternative sort of arrangement, probably along like an all-island solution, in which Northern Ireland probably retains close alignment to the single market in some areas, but gives the Northern Ireland Assembly a say over when and how it diverges from those rules. I think from the EU's perspective, they are very much only going to agree to something which is compatible with the objectives of the current backstop. So it sort of has to do the same thing. It can do it in a slightly different way, but effectively it has to prevent that border along the Northern Ireland and the Ireland and Republic. So, I mean, how likely it is, I think we're seeing positive tones come out that deal was possible, and that minds in government and the EU are focused in terms of making progress. It was only a few weeks ago the EU was saying that the withdrawal agreement wasn't going to be open for any negotiation. So I think we are seeing some progress, but I think there's still a long way to go, given the EU's sort of tone to some of the proposals that the UK has put down.
Yeah, but certainly the tone does seem a little better from the EU. And what about from the Irish government? Do they seem to be on board with the idea of trying to reach an agreement?
Yeah, I think they're open to solutions, as I say, that meet the objectives of the current backstop. So they will, if they are going to climb down from saying, okay, a backstop, the UK backstop is the only way, is the only solution, then it has to be a solution which they can still point to that meets what that backstop does.
And so the objectives of the backstop being to avoid a hard border across the island of Ireland, and particularly in the context of the peace process.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So imagining a scenario in which the EU and the Irish were on board with an agreement a bit like the one you laid out, and the government are happy with it, the question is always, can this get through Parliament? You know, that's been the problem mm-hmm. we've had with previous deals. So what's yeah. your assessment there?
So we've taken a look at this and done some number crunching to see what the likelihood is. I think the first point to make is obviously we haven't seen what the deal looks like, so it's very hard to predict. But based on a sort of all-island solution, which the DUP managed to get on board with, we think...
That's a huge change.
Because I think the DUP getting on board is important for some of those hardline ERGers, you know. So I think if you can get the DUP on board, I think there is definitely room for this withdrawal agreement to pass. I think you are going to get some Conservative MPs who will not back it purely because, you know, they will only support the purest form of Brexit, if you like.
And this is the European Research Group.
That's correct.
And yeah. that is a group which no one ever seems to quite know how big it is, between 60 and 80 people.
That's
but
correct.
You've
yeah.
got like the people who are sort of kind of in it, and then the people who are like, this is their reason for existence.
That you're right. So there's up to 80 people, I think, in this group, but only 28 voted against the withdrawal agreement, the third attempt. So yep. I think working from that basis, I think that's where the government will be making it, like focusing its efforts. You know, these 28 that voted against it, voted against Theresa May's deal the third time. If they come back with a new deal, how many of these can they get on board?
And if they've got the DUP on board, then that should flip a few more over.
I think it would. And I think, you know, as we've seen here today with the decision by the Supreme Court and the Benn legislation that was passed, I think these MPs now know that if they don't pass this deal, then who knows what might happen further down. By that I mean second referendum or revoking Article 50. So I think you could probably see single figures in the numbers of Conservatives that end up voting against that deal. What's very important is the amount of Labour MPs that come round supporting the deal, because you will get a few that...
Because you're miles short of a majority anyway, and well, so only losing single figures doesn't really help.
Well, yeah. exactly. So you need double figure Labour MPs to basically come on board, possibly as many as 20. 17 Labour MPs have publicly committed to supporting some form of Brexit deal if it returns. In reality...
Against the whip of their own party.
Yeah, so the likes of Caroline Flint, Stephen Kinnock have been very vocal in that they would be willing to support a sensible Brexit deal. You know, they've said they would, you know, regret now not voting for, in some cases, not voting for Theresa May's deal. In reality, I think, you know, it's very hard to say whether or not those Labour MPs do come down. Do they give... like Boris Johnson, you know, a free pass basically to deliver Brexit
yeah.
against the whip. So I'm also conscious that before, when Theresa May was trying to pass her deal, there was speculation that up to 30 or 40 Labour MPs might, you know, come round and back it. In the end, only five did. So I think 17 publicly committing it is important, though, because, you know, they would have to row back from that quite significantly.
What about abstentions? So you've really, your numbers have worked on the basis that everybody votes one way or the other, but is there scope for more than those 17, say, to just not be prepared to vote against it, or, you know, or for maybe some of the Tories to abstain?
I think abstention for the deal is possible but unlikely. I think on this issue, if Boris Johnson comes back with the deal, I think MPs will want to be seen to be decisive and to sort, and you know, they won't want to be seen to be dithering, you know, whether or not they support it or not. And I think they will have to come down one way or the other.
Right. And I mean, I guess from a Labour MP's perspective, and we obviously, the conference just wrapped up, is there a sense that they're kind of relishing this opportunity to have a general election for on the topic of Brexit? As you know, if a deal doesn't get done, that's the next thing that's going to happen, presumably. So is yeah. that, does that look like a good option for them?
So Labour really won't want to fight, I think, the election on a Brexit footing, in terms of only going about and talking about Brexit, because they are, as we've seen over the last few days, very divided about this issue, about whether or not, you know, they've come round to the idea now of supporting a second referendum, but now they don't know whether this would be in such a referendum where they would vote to remain, or whether they would campaign for a new deal which they would negotiate. So they would be looking to really to focus on their domestic issues, which in the previous election, 2017, seems to have very good cut through with the public. So I think they would be looking to have a similar sort of strategy once the election does come along.
And if we have a general election with Brexit not having been resolved now, does that, like, obviously the Conservatives also want to have their domestic agenda cutting through the Brexit noise, but does that seem likely that that can happen in the same way that it did in 2017?
You won't be able to escape Brexit at the election. So, Boris Johnson, the Conservatives, they will do everything possible to make sure that this is, if you like, a Brexit election. You know, they've already framed the Benn legislation as the surrender bill. So I think they'll be using lots of those narrative in terms of Jeremy Corbyn favours more delay, wants to, you know, won't respect the referendum result. You know, that sort of language will run throughout the campaign, you'd expect. And likewise with Labour, you would probably see lots of highlighting the result that came today, Boris Johnson lying to the Queen, etc., stuff like that. So I think we'll see that sort of narrative play out at a general election. It will be unavoidable.
And then, so the Labour policy, as determined on Monday, is extend Article 50, strike a new deal, hold a referendum on that deal, and then implement it, and then reform the EU from within the EU.
Not quite. So what they agreed on Monday was, you're right, extend Article 50, renegotiate a deal which would be a lot closer to the EU than the deal that Theresa May negotiated.
Yeah.
They would then have a second referendum. Mm. But before they got to that second referendum point, they would have a one-day conference.
The one-day conference,
to decide whether or not to campaign for Remain or to support the new deal that they would have negotiated. And that's where, at the moment, the lack of clarity is on the Labour side in terms of which way they would.
Because that one-day conference is the thing that essentially would keep the EU honest. Because if you know how Labour's going to campaign, then essentially you don't have a great incentive to offer very much in the deal.
That's right, and they're also nervous about coming out full force like the Lib Dems have of saying revoking Article 50 or saying we really do need to remain because of the seats that they have up north, which voted Leave quite heavily in some areas, and they would be worried that the Conservatives might manage to pick a few of those seats off if they were to be so explicitly pro-Remain.
Sure, because the referendum result was 52-48, of course, but in terms of constituencies, it's a much more, if you're going to fight this battle in a general election, there are actually much more, a much greater number of Leave voting constituencies. So does that just leave Labour at a big disadvantage, and does that validate this strategy the Conservatives have, the purge, whatever you want to call it, of having absolute purity of message compared to Labour's strategic ambiguity?
So I think Labour's strategy and election, they're probably going to lose some more seats up in Scotland and up north, but they are hoping, I think, to take some of the sort of the Remain focused areas in London and across the south. Just to focus in on the sort of the north of England, which in lots of places is Labour but voted to leave, the Conservative strategy will be obviously to try and pick off a lot of those seats, given they'll probably lose some seats down south. But in a lot of these areas, you have had people who have voted Labour their entire life. They might have voted Brexit and they might be strongly in favour of Leave, but when it comes to the ballot box, whether or not they'll be able to tick the, you know, tick the Conservative box, I think be
sort of holding their noses.
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think for some people that will be the case. I'm not saying that strategy can't work, and you know, who knows, I'll be proven wrong and they'll get a 100 seat majority. But I think it's a real tough ask for the Conservatives, especially when, you know, down south there's lots of areas which are very pro-Remain, which they currently hold, which they probably lose in some areas to the Lib Dems.
Okay, yeah, and so let's talk about the Lib Dems then. Their conference seems like ancient history now, but obviously it seemed to have quite a vibe about it. And I mean, have they succeeded in having a very clear message on Brexit?
So I think it potentially might have been a bit of a risk for Jo Swinson to come out so pro-Remain and just say, you know, we're not even in favour of a second referendum now, we just want to revoke Article 50 if we get into power. I guess the beauty of that position is that they probably know they won't be in government. She probably won't be the prime minister. So it allows her the freedom to potentially be...
Because that's her caveat, isn't it?
Yeah,
the caveat
exactly,
is,
yeah.
This is our policy if we get a majority.
Well, exactly. So I think in reality...
So this is our policy in essentially what is pretty close to a complete and total fantasy.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, if they get into a position where they are the kingmakers, if you like, either a coalition or a competency supply agreement, I think the minimum they would ask for is definitely a second referendum.
Yeah.
But, you know, now that they're so pro-Remain, who knows, they might, you know, that might be the, you know, but that would be unlikely to get Labour and Conservative support. So I think you're right. I think they have the freedom of being able to effectively say what they like in that regard.
So probably that's the, what you've described is probably much, I mean, I assume they wouldn't. I think they've been clear they wouldn't enter a coalition.
You're right, yeah. So, yeah, with the current leaders of those parties, so if Boris Johnson if it was not Jeremy Corbyn in power and leading those parties, then they've sort of caveated that you know, they might be open to looking at it then. But I think, you know, they probably learned a lot of lessons from the last coalition government,
yeah.
That they're not, that they wouldn't rush into to doing anything which they didn't feel that they would benefit them.
So the reality of their policy is probably... that they're in favour of a second referendum.
Yeah, I think they would still, you know, get on board with a second referendum,
yeah.
Revoking Article 50. You know, it doesn't have, there's not a majority for that in Parliament by any means. So,
and is there the Remain alliance? Is that something that's still in effect? Or
yeah.
So
this is the Conservative number. This was the former Conservative MPs who lost the whip, obviously, to vote. I think what they do over the next few weeks will be very interesting now that Parliament is being recalled. What they do, as I say, they'll probably use the time to further scrutinise the government's position and how likely it is that they get a deal. Lots of these MPs would vote for a deal. There'll be a few, like Dominic Grieve, that probably won't under any circumstances because they want a second referendum. But I think a lot of them, the likes of Rory Stewart, for example, Philip Hammond, I think they would vote for...
Oliver Letwin.
Exactly. They will vote for a sensible deal. That's what I think they want Boris Johnson to get on and try and do.
Okay, so, I mean, that's the kind of lay of the land. I guess the one remaining question then to ask is, when's this general election going to take place, Chris?
Well, so before Parliament is now, so after Parliament was prorogued, the earliest it was going to be able to have been would have been late November. But now that Parliament's sitting again, we might see another general election motion, or we might see a vote no confidence. I think that's unlikely to get the necessary support, because I think the opposition have said they won't support general election until Johnson's been forced to ask for the extension if he doesn't manage to get enough support to pass his deal. I think...
And just, you know, the political optics of being the opposition and spending, you know, that's going to have been like 2 months or something... not supporting a general election.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be able to do it forever, and I think they know that, and I think that's why, you know, they have the line that they want Boris Johnson to ask for the extension if he doesn't secure a deal. So I think after October the 19th, whatever happens, whether or not we get a deal, whether or not he asks for the extension, I think the longer that plays out, I think it'll be harder for the opposition to stay with that line. So I do think late November, possibly spring, looks like possible times for a general election. I'm early spring probably now seems like a little bit more likely.
Blimey. That seems a long time away.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of sort of concern that amongst Conservatives and Labour about holding an election in the winter, potentially low turnout, and campaigning in the winter, probably not ideal either. So I think. You know, you definitely can't rule out the possibility of an election sort of in between March and May. But yeah, I think late November does still look like it could be a possibility as well.
Okay, well, I think that's about all we've got time for. So thank you very much, Chris. And if I know some of the numbers that we were talking about earlier are really difficult to follow, but I would advise if you want to see some of the work that Chris and his colleagues produce, then following them on Twitter with the handle @CiceroGlobal is a really good way to do so, and they release tables showing how those different votes break down, which is really helpful and informative. Okay, so thank you very much for listening to all our listeners. We hope you will join us again for the next Brewin podcast.